I'll briefly discuss the sutra title. It's the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. Hridaya just means heart. So it's the heart of the perfect wisdom. And this is a highly condensed summary of the 100,000 line, 25,000 line, 18,000 line, 10,000 line, 5,000 line, or 8,000 line Perfect Wisdom Sutras. And it was written quite a bit late, and it's designed to condense the ideas of the sutras in their simplest form. The difficulty is it's so condensed that it's hard to construe. So we'll try to pick it apart a little bit. Bhaga means womb. So Bhagavat means merciful one, compassionate one, or blessed one. And Prajnaparamita, paramita means perfection. There are six paramitas. The wisdom perfection is the final one, the key one. So the word prajna, I translate it perfect wisdom. That's the usual way of translating it. An alternate translation that's more precise is discriminating insight. But that doesn't sound as good, so here it's perfect wisdom. But the idea is that the insight of prajna goes deep and deep and deeper. And it differentiates subtle distinctions. And the deeper it goes, the subtler it is. And pra, that prefix, means towards in one meaning. And this jna is cognate to the word gnostic, for instance, to the word knowing. And in Buddhist terms, it's considered to mean omniscience, which is all knowledge. And it's all knowledge in the sense that anything you need or want to know, you can know instantly, apparently. So the perfection of wisdom, or the perfecting of wisdom, is really the discriminating insight that leads in the direction of omniscience. Thus have I heard. Every sutra begins with that phrase. Oh, I forgot. Hridaya, heart, and sutra. Sutra, the literal meaning of that is a thread. And that weaving analogy holds up cross-culturally. The thread ties the ideas together in a sequence. The text, like a textile, is what's the combination of all those threads. And in Chinese, the sutras are called jing, which means the warp of the loom. So they're the main threads of a loom. And then the commentaries are called the way, which is the secondary threads that go the other way across the textile. So I'm not sure why, but the words for a sacred text are exactly tied up with the idea of weaving. So we're weaving together some ideas. Now, thus have I heard is what you could call a pious fiction. This is Ananda, who was Shakyamuni Buddha's body servant and cousin, had been to all the Dharma assemblies, and he had a photographic memory. So he remembered all the sutras in detail. And after Buddha died, they had a big assembly, and the sutras were recited and memorized. They had incredible memories in those days. And the people that hadn't been in the assembly could hear it once and remember it. So that established the definitive scriptures for the first 500 years. And it was written down, I think, 100 or 200 years later. It was passed on orally before then. So there's a long oral tradition preceding the writing. And then for the Mahayana sutras, since they're claiming that it's the Buddha word, then they use that, thus have I heard, as an indication that it's a real sutra. That's part of the Buddha word. Okay, and then it says where the sutra take place, where the assembly was. This is at Vulture Peak or Eagle Peak in Rajagriha, a site in Bihar in India. Excuse the asthma. A site in India, which is like a natural amphitheater. It has rock formations and there's a stone seat on top, or a stone that could be used as a seat, and then room for an assembly to sit on the slopes. So they're painting a picture of this being an actual assembly. And then there's a gathering of monks, nuns, and bodhisattvas. And usually there are various gods and magical, mythological critters also present in the assembly. They're not mentioned here. Okay, and at the time of the assembly, the first thing that Shakyamuni Buddha did, he entered into a samadhi. Samadhi literally means putting it together, and it's a name for a deep concentration, a meditative state that's extremely deep. And there are different kinds of samadhis mentioned, and this one is called Appearance of the Profound, and it involves the enumeration of phenomena. Now, phenomena in this case refer to a very complicated system called the Abhidharma, which is a system designed to explore the mind, the surface mind and the deeper mind. And it entails 100 kinds of these dharmas or so. And the idea is that dharmas could be called atoms of experience. Then every moment would be a molecule of experience. So every moment rises and falls. And each moment is a combination of these dharmas. So the enumeration of phenomena would be the counting of these dharmas as they rise and fall. 100 is too many to get your head around, so they divide it into 5 categories called skandhas. And these skandhas are the process of the mind. And that process of the mind is thought in the old days to exist objectively. And that process is what replaces any thought of a self or an ego. So rather than there being a real self, the self is considered to be imaginary. What's real in the Abhidharma system are the 5 skandhas, which include material form, feeling, which is defined as an immediate reaction to a sense perception. So the emotions we have, the feelings we have, are built on that foundation. You know, the idea is to get to the core of these things. So to get to the foundation of emotions, you look at feeling, which is a instantaneous reaction to a sense perception. Either you like it, you don't like it, or you don't care. And then the skanda called perception. The skanda called perception is the entire process of perception from the sense contact up to the recognition and naming of the object. The fourth skanda is called the samskaras, usually rendered as karmic formations. And these are the motivations, the things that drive our mind. So you have virtuous and non-virtuous dharmas and neutral dharmas, all of which form impulses to action. Action of body. Action of speech. Action of mind. The fifth skanda is called consciousness, and it's dualistic consciousness. It's the thinking mind, mostly automatic, that drives the whole mechanism, the process of the human experience in each moment. So that's the structure of the enumeration of phenomena. That's, in a nutshell, the Abhidharma system. Now, the Buddha is doing this. I should mention, there are three main characters in this sutra. Shakyamuni Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, and Shariputra. And it's interesting to note that deep texts are often written in the form of dialogue. And for instance, Plato's philosophical writings are all in dialogue form. Galileo's scientific breakthroughs were written down in dialogue form. Erasmus's Praise of Folly is a dialogue. Even Bateson's recent Steps to an Ecology of Mind was written as a dialogue with his daughter. So there's a deep reason for bringing these ideas forth in the terms of a dialogue. I'm not sure exactly why that's done, but it's common. Okay, this is going to be a dialogue between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra. So we need to know who these people are. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva, an enlightening being. Actually, a Buddha appearing as a bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion. And in fact, some people have called the entirety of Buddhism the religion of compassion. In any case, Avalokiteshvara is a very advanced being. And he's not only the bodhisattva of compassion, but he deeply understands the wisdom of the Buddha. Now, Shariputra is the primary expert in the Abhidharma system in the Buddhist assembly. He had mastered the wisdom of the Abhidharma, and he was very adept at enumerating the phenomena and observing these dharmas at a deep level. However, he was totally unaware of the perfection of wisdom and of the principle of emptiness. So Avalokiteshvara goes into the mode of cognition of emptiness, and proceeds to teach Shariputra the new form, the perfection of wisdom, which is an outgrowth of the original Abhidharma system. Now his name, Avalokiteshvara, means he who looks down from on high. The idea is he sees all the sufferings of the world and has compassion for those sufferings. Then Tara over there is the Buddha or Bodhisattva of action of compassion. And she takes up the compassion and acts on it. I think that Tara and Prajnaparamita as deities are very similar, in fact, different facets of the same goddess. In any case, Avalokiteshvara was practicing the profound perfection of wisdom. The actual text says he was moving in the course of the emptiness of the perfection of wisdom, something of that sort. So he was deep within the practice of perfection of wisdom, and he clearly saw those five skandhas I mentioned to be empty of essential nature. Empty of essential nature means that they have no objective existence. They're momentary. Every moment the skandhas change because the dharmas that make them up have changed. They're the same kinds of dharmas often, but they're different. They have re-arisen out of the emptiness. So he clearly perceived that. The people in the assembly had all worked with the five skandhas and believed them to be real because they experienced the process that replaces the idea of an ego. So there's no ego involved. We think there is, but in fact what's going on is the psychological process of the five skandhas mutating over time. So he saw all that clearly. And then Shariputra, who's the expert in Abhidharma, by the inspiration of the Buddha, asks Avalokiteshvara a question. And this again is a feature of almost all sutras. There's an assembly, they say who was there, and then one or the other of the disciples asks the Buddha a direct question. And then the rest of the sutra is the answer to that question. In this case, it's Shariputra that asks the question to Avalokita. And what he asks is, wishing to practice the profound perfection of wisdom, how should a son or daughter of good lineage train? In Buddhism, we're taught to train ourselves. You know, we're given ideas for practices. We work with those practices and we train in them. So in this case, Shariputra was very interested in the perfection of wisdom because he knew it was an extension some way of the Abhidharma, a deepening of the Abhidharma, as it were. So he asked Avalokiteshvara that question, you know, how should we train if we want to practice the perfection of wisdom? And the rest of the sutra is Avalokita's reply. And he starts out by saying, a son or daughter of good lineage who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should discern in this way, view the five skandhas to be empty of essential nature. Emptiness is a very curious concept, and it's always empty of something. Something is empty of itself. It's not not usually thought of as a vast void. That could lead people into nihilism. And in Buddhism, we're to avoid both the view of nihilism, nothing at all exists, and the view of eternalism, everything exists endlessly because it rises and falls. So everything in our experience is impermanent, temporary. And if we slow our minds down with meditation, then we're able to perceive more clearly the rising and falling of each moment. But usually our minds are too fast, so we miss all that. The thing about the mind is we're only aware of what goes on the surface, and the depths of the mind are unknown to most people. And meditation and practice is designed to get us to those deeper levels so we begin to understand who and what we are. And the perfection of wisdom, the practice of that, is one of the techniques that's used to get to the deep levels of the mind. So Avalokiteshvara answers, view the five skandhas to be empty of essential nature. Essential nature means it really exists over time and space. You know, that a thing is a standalone existing entity. And if you think about it, nothing stands alone. Everything is interconnected with everything else. It's what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. You know, it's total interdependence of everything. So that means that separating out any entity from the field of total existence is arbitrary. You know, it's a mere concept. And being a mere concept, the attribution of an essential nature to that is essentially an illusion. The essential nature is that it's interconnected with everything. So then it goes through the five skandhas. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Form is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than form. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. In the same way, feeling, perception, recognition, karmic formation, and consciousness are emptiness. So all these things that they spent hours and hours and hours observing are now said to be essentially non-existent. And that was a shocker to a lot of Hinayana people. Most of them didn't want to accept the Mahayana for those kind of reasons. There's a scholar in Seattle named Carl Brunholzl who wrote a book called The Heart Attack Sutra. And he called it the Heart Attack Sutra because some Hinayana people, when they heard that sutra, had a heart attack. They couldn't believe that their whole system was, in fact, an arbitrary construct. And that's basically what the principle of emptiness is, that everything is an arbitrary concept constructed by the mind. And what really exists is mostly unknown, but it's interconnected with everything else that exists. So these five skandhas are shown to be empty of any essential nature, of any what is called a svabhava, own being. So in themselves, they're nothing. They're just nodes in a network of existence. And then he goes on to say these dharmas, okay, these dharmas that everybody thought was real, is also a mere construct. And so he says, here, O Shariputra, all phenomena are marked with emptiness. They have no characteristics. In other words, everything that differentiates one dharma from another, it's said that each dharma has a unique mark. And in that system, it's like the mark of fire is smoke. You know, the mark of a storm is the gray clouds, and so on like that. So they have an elaborate system of ascribing a mark to each of these dharmas. And in this case, this is no, if they're only marked with emptiness, they're all the same, essentially. So they have no characteristics. And then it goes on to mention three characteristics that dharmas are thought to have. No arising and no cessation, because they rise and fall every moment. no impurity and no purity. Some dharmas are pure, some dharmas are impure. That distinction doesn't apply in emptiness. There is no decrease and no increase. Some dharmas can be deficient and can grow, or could grow, and other dharmas are complete, like empty space is complete. So nothing decreases, nothing increases. So then it turns again. We've now annihilated the idea of these dharmas being real. And I should mention here that if the dharmas are not real, the skandhas are certainly not real. So then he goes on to list everything that doesn't exist. So there is no form, no feeling, no recognition, no karmic formation, no consciousness. Those are the five skandhas again. In emptiness, there's no such thing. And then it goes through the six sense organs, in this case, the consciousness mind, the dualistic mind, the automatic mind, is considered to be a sense organ. It senses thoughts, the way the ear hears sounds. So these organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, don't exist in emptiness. It's all an illusion. And then the objects of those sense organs also don't exist. So there's no visual appearance, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no phenomena, no dharmas for the mind to observe. And then it goes on, no eye element up to no mind element, and so on up to no mind consciousness element. This refers to what are called the 18 ayatanas, the 18 dhatus. And these dhatus are the pairs, organ object, that makes 12 of them because there are six organs and six objects. And then once there's a sense contact between an organ and an object, there arises a consciousness of that sense contact. And that's called the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, and so forth. So those 18 things don't exist. So basically what's being done here is to take apart the system that describes the process of sense perception, the process of being conscious, at least in a dualistic sense. So they've basically deconstructed all that stuff and said, no, it's just a concept. It's not real. It has no own being, no essential nature. And then it goes on to mention the key items of the Buddha Dharma, starting with the Four Noble Truths, which most people have heard of anyway. The Four Noble Truths are the first thing Buddha ever taught. And they're an outline of the entire rest of the Dharma. Any item of Dharma that you can find belongs under one or the other of those four truths. And I won't go into that now. I did a talk mentioning it in detail before. Probably have to repeat the whole series. Because these things have to be heard more than once. There's something about the Dharma that, I've heard that before, doesn't apply. The oftener we can hear these things, the deeper the understanding can go. So ignorance is the primary cause of our suffering. Not knowing reality as it is, but putting imaginary forms onto this reality and then identifying with those imaginary forms. So, anyway, this ignorance is the root cause of our suffering. And here it talks about the 12 links of dependent arising, which I won't describe, except to say that it's a very brilliant way of summarizing cause and effect, the second noble truth. So in the theory of dependent arising of cause and effect, it starts out with ignorance, goes to that fourth skanda of the items of mind that motivate us to action of body, speech, or thinking. And that said that those things, linking up to no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. The idea being, if you can arrive at the extinction of ignorance, then this whole pattern of suffering mind just collapses. So it goes through ignorance up to the extinction of ignorance, up to the extinction of aging and death. And none of this exists in emptiness. You know, it's all a construct. So what they're doing, they've deconstructed the phenomenal world, or the view of the phenomenal world. Now they're destructing the Dharma itself and saying that it's a hallucination, basically. That the Dharma is a construct designed to get people out of suffering. And that's the purpose of it. The suffering is not the pain we experience being in this world, but rather the thing that our crazy mind makes out of our situation. In other words, we create our own suffering. And these systems are designed to reduce that amount of suffering by replacing the imaginary with the real. In other words, the actual that exists is what we want to perceive, not what our crazy minds make of any situation. We've all been in situations where we assumed something was going on, and then when it unfolded, we realized we were totally misconstruing the situation. In fact, something totally else was going on. They're applying that across the board to all of our experience. So we make ourselves suffer unnecessarily by ignoring, being ignorant of, or not accepting things as they are. So this whole principle of a cause and effect existence of suffering and the Four Noble Truths, none of that exists in emptiness. It's all a construct. It's made up in order to help us get out of our suffering. So it's a matter of compassion that the system was devised in the first place. And it's a little bit hard to realize that this system, if you've been practicing for years, and some of us have, that this system we've been practicing is in fact also a construct, and that the reality is to be found beyond concept. And to get to non-conceptual mind, you can use the Dharma as a kind of springboard. But what they're saying here is the Dharma is a construct, so don't take it literally. Or rather, take it as literally as you need to work it, to practice it, but realize that it's only a construct. So we've deconstructed the 12 links of dependent arising, and then the Four Noble Truths themselves. And then it goes on to say, there is no attainment and no non-attainment. And it's, again, hard to hear if you've been practicing. There's nothing to attain. But then they add, neither is there any non-attainment. There's not any unattainment. So it takes the idea of attainment and deconstructs it. And then, at this point, the sutra kind of pivots. They've already brought everything existing into emptiness, both the perceptual world that we experience and the Dharma that teaches about the perceptual world. And then it goes on, because the bodhisattvas have no attainment, they rely on the perfection of wisdom. So the perfection of wisdom gets you through the emptiness, allows you to course in emptiness, allows you to accept the non-existence of what you thought was real. Then it says, since there is no obscuration, there is no fear. You know, when you have the rug pulled out from under you, the tendency is to become afraid. It's like, good grief, where am I? No orientation, no reference point. And in emptiness, there are no reference points. So the bodhisattvas have to be courageous to the extent of having removed all of their obscurations. Obscurations come in two flavors. There's the kleshas, the negative emotions, which are again part of the fourth skanda. These negative emotions obscure our feeling nature, and we suffer because of these kleshas, because of these disturbances in our mind stream. And it's possible through practice and spiritual purification to rid ourselves of these kleshas. And a lot of the work of practicing Buddhism is exactly about eliminating these negative emotions, which can only be done gradually. Okay, then say the kleshas are all removed. Then we're not making automatic reactions to states of feeling. You know, we have a level of equanimity, a level of calm. So that's a very good thing. But then there's more. The obstructions of mind, the obstructions of view. And they say that these obstructions make us see reality in the wrong way. And if we see reality in the wrong way, then we're motivated to do things that are not in balance, in harmony with the rest of the universe. Doing things in the wrong way is a result of this set of wrong views that we may have. So in order to remove the obstructions of view and to fully understand what emptiness really means, and it goes in levels. So we're looking at the first level of the concept of emptiness. And then as the concept of emptiness gets more subtle, then it's possible to realize emptiness, which is totally non-conceptual. In any case, the bodhisattvas, when they get to that phase, there are no more obscurations. They've removed all of the negative emotions and all of the wrong views, so there's no obscuration to their cognition. And because of that, there's no fear, because there's nothing to be afraid of. The constructs of the mind are basically an illusion. And since there are no obscurations, then they're beyond error. And I had to use the word error, even though it has Catholic connotations, if you're a recovering Catholic. But what it refers to is four what are called upside-down views. These upside-down views are an attempt to find happiness in what is intrinsically suffering. That's the movie that our minds make. We try to find a happy movie. And the movie that we're making because of our obscurations is completely bound up with suffering. So the attempt to find happiness in suffering is one of the upside-down views. And then the attempt to find purity in what is intrinsically impure is another one of the upside-down views. Now, this is a little bit dualistic, but they're saying basically that the world itself is impure and that purity belongs only to the spiritual life. So that emptiness dissolves that distinction as well. But the search for purity in an impure world is going to be wrought with suffering. Let's see, we did the purity, the search for what is permanent in impermanence. Now, a lot of this is in the commentary, which I wrote to be as simple as possible and as close to the text as possible. So it's advisable to read that in your spare time and link it up with the words of the sutra. In any case, these four upside-down views are transcended. They no longer exist, and when this happens, then nirvana arises naturally. So you have complete enlightenment. And then these bodhisattvas have no obscuration, no fear. They transcend the four upside-down views, and they attain complete nirvana. And because of that, they pass beyond the bounds of sorrow. In other words, there's no more misery. There might still be pain, but there's no misery. So this section then is what happens to the bodhisattvas when they practice perfection of wisdom in its full form. And then it goes on to talk about the Buddhas. All the Buddhas are the three times. That's past, present, and future. By means of perfect wisdom. In other words, perfect wisdom is the mother of all Buddhas. That's why it's a goddess. She is the mother of all Buddhas in that only through the perfection of wisdom can enlightenment be obtained. So the Buddhas of the three times, using that means of training in perfect wisdom, have become fully awakened to the utmost true and complete enlightenment. That's a nice phrase. Anuttara samyak sambodhi. Anuttara means without limit, without peer. Anuttara samyak means orthodox or righteous. Right, so utmost right and perfect enlightenment is one translation. So anuttara samyak, sam is a particle that emphasizes whatever follows it. So you have sambodhi, it's ultimate enlightenment, complete enlightenment. So this perfection of wisdom, and they're blowing their own horn here, they've managed to deconstruct everything, and then they said that even the Buddha's nirvana is done by means of perfect wisdom. Okay, now that completes the prose in the sutra, and then it goes on to do the short form, and a mantra means holding the mind. It's a thing that you chant, and mantras all have rhythms, and sometimes they have meanings. The idea with this mantra is to summarize the entire path in a few words. So the words are gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, enlightenment, so be it. And again, if you have leisure, try chanting that seven times every once in a while. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. And there's dozens of tunes to sing that by, but I don't remember them right now, and the voice is not well trained, so we'll just do it in ordinary plain song. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. In fact, let's try it. Let's try doing that seven times. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate para gate para sam gate Bodhisvaha. And then there's an advertisement for that mantra. And it goes, it's the great mantra, it's the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering. It is true because it is not false. That could be a pop-up. But we don't do pop-ups on our website, luckily. And then the remainder of the text is back to the assembly. This is everything that Avalokiteshvara has said to Shariputra. And then back at the assembly, the Buddha then arises from the samadhi, a profound illumination that deals with the enumeration of phenomena, the cognizance of the dharmas. And it's to be noted that the skandhas are difficult enough to get into view. I've tried picking apart my experience and putting them in those five categories. And I don't know why it's so hard to do, but it's hard to focus the mind on that activity of thinking of the mind as being a process. Ah, I see a form, that's the form skandha. I like that form, so my reaction is positive in that case. I name that form window with trees. And that's the perception skandha. And then the samskaras, the karmic motivators, are quiescent at that point. And my conscious mind then labels it windows with trees. So that process goes on every instant. And it's hard to focus the mind on that. You have to really slow the mind down to do it. And the dharmas are worse yet. That's why they lived in caves for years. Because they had to slow the mind down incredibly much in order to perceive these instantaneous dharmas rising and falling. So it's really one of the deep insights of Shakyamuni Buddha that he was able to arrive at that profound depth of mind in order to even be aware of these things, because it happens in a finger snap, a 10,000th of a second. Dharmas arise, fall, next dharma comes up. It may be similar to the last moment, but the dharmas are different. And so it's a puzzle. So Buddha arises from that samadhi and he praises Avalokiteshvara for his teaching. Says, well done, O son of good lineage, thus it is. Practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have taught. And then the Buddhas rejoice. And then the entire assembly rejoices. And here's the mention of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas. Asuras are the anti-gods, the titans of the mythology. The gods live in these cushy circumstances, and the asuras are always trying to take heaven by storm. And the lowest level of the heavens are the four protecting kings that muster their armies to fight off the asuras. So even the gods have a little bit of trouble. But anyway, those asuras have set aside their enmity and showed up with the gods at this assembly in order to hear the Dharma. It's said that there can be bodhisattvas in any of the six realms of existence, which are the heaven worlds, the Asura world, the Titan world, the human world. Those are the four upper rebirths. Then the lower rebirths are the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realms. And the most useful way to look at that, I'm not saying that these realms don't exist in other dimensions, maybe they do, but the useful consideration of the six realms is again related to the human mind. It's like our mind and experience can be in a hell realm, like you wouldn't want to be in Aleppo right now. The hungry ghost realm Look at Darfur with all the starvation. The hungry ghosts simply can't get enough food. The animal realm, look at how the animals suffer, especially lately when we have these mechanized egg farms and mechanized cattle farms, where the feedlots are so narrowly confined that the animals can't even turn around in their cages. That's real suffering. So animals suffer from being exploited by humans and by the tooth and claw aspects of their situation. Then humans are a mixed bag. If we embrace the highest level of our humanity, then we become compassionate beings and very effective in helping other sentient beings, including those in the lower realms. In Buddhism, you can get reborn as an animal or a ghost or a hell being, or if you do good karma, you can get born in the heavens. But if you do, there's a limited lifespan. They say that if you want to achieve real liberation, full enlightenment, that this can only be done in the human realm. Because in the God realm, things are so cushy that they don't think to practice much Dharma. And what happens in the God realm, they have very long lifespans. So, humans thought they were probably immortal, but they're not. Eventually, a God runs out of the God realm karma and falls back into the lower worlds. And if they have if they have bad karma that's undealt with, they can even fall from heaven back into hell. Or they can fall back to the human world. And there they might achieve liberation if they practice the Dharma. So all these beings are now present in the assembly that Shakyamuni Buddha taught the Wisdom Sutra in. That is a wrap. I know that was pretty condensed, but you've heard it once, and hearing it once is a very good thing. You have to hear it a number more times before the understanding starts to blossom. But hooray, the seed has been planted. Now, we have time for Q&A, but I'm going to shut down the recorder, I think.